Mary, do you want this or that?
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I'll be.
We'll call a meeting to order. This is a State Government Finance Committee meeting for Tuesday, January 31st, 2012. We do have a quorum, and we have the minutes. Would someone move the minutes from the meeting from yesterday, the 30th?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move minutes.
Moved by Representative Benson. Any additions or corrections? I said yesterday, I meant last Thursday, right? Hearing no additions or corrections, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Looks like we're trying to get our technology up to speed here for the first presentation.
Yeah, we could work on that.
Yeah, so we have two documents, and so we could just work off of those. If we want.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah, because I printed the report.
Okay.
Sent out to.
Yeah.
Just
the document camera.
That's weird. Make sure the overhead. Maybe I should bring that up. Now we look at a picture. This is going to work.
Yeah, we tried all of ours hitting and registering.
Commissioner Kronk, welcome to the meeting.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Today we're here to present on a report that was released on January 15th called the Enterprise Data Analytics Master Contract Program. Hopefully you have a copy of that in front of you, and then a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that we are preparing to talk about today. Just so you're aware, Betsy, that everything that you do is highlighted on the screen. We're very excited to talk about this report with all members of this committee. We believe that over the past 6 months, we've made incredible progress, both based on recommendations by the legislature and of interest for the governor. And so I wanted to start out with the first page of our PowerPoint with a quote from the governor. He really said, "We who serve in state government have an important obligation to improve how it works. Our state government must provide better services more efficiently at lower costs." And we're all in agreement on this area. I think that it's important both from the Department of Administration and from all members of the governor's cabinet that we can really work at how we can make government better. This program in particular is adding to the tools that all state agencies have to improve the services and the quality of the services that they provide to Minnesota citizens. The Department of Administration directly reflects that because we went through a refreshment of our mission statement over the past 6 months. We really focused in on that we want to provide the best value in government administrative services by emphasizing customer satisfaction, continuous improvement, and employee engagement. That second piece of continuous improvement, reducing costs and cycle times, optimizing performance, and delivering innovative business solutions at every opportunity, is something that we want to talk, like integrate in the DNA of every staff member of the Department of Administration when they wake up in the morning and they say, how can I improve the way that I do work for the state of Minnesota? One tool that we have at our disposal at the request of the legislature was this data analytics master contract. The goal of the data analytics initiative is to enhance the ability for agencies to discover cost savings opportunities, promote efficiencies, and achieve quality improvements by making data-driven decisions. This idea is an integral component of the governor's and legislative charge to make continuous improvement part of the DNA of state government. There were four areas that I'll speak to that were part of this state government finance omnibus bill regarding data analytics: tax compliance, state building efficiency, fleet management services, strategic sourcing. There was also an additional component in the Health and Human Service Finance Bill on Medicaid fraud, mispayment, prevention, and detection. We took all five of those and wanted to combine them into a larger master contract program that all state agencies could use. And over the next few slides, I'll talk about that master contract program and how we developed it over the past 9 months. Back in April, the Department Administration formed multi-agency focus groups to identify potential uses of data analytics. We issued an RFP to establish Enterprise Data Analytics Master Contract. In May, we had a steering team that hosted a pre-proposal conference that was attended by more than 40 prospective vendors. In June, 29 vendor proposals were received for the program. Between July and August, we evaluated the RFP with 13 subject matter experts from 8 different agencies. In October and November, we negotiated contracts that and then selected 22 vendors. And then on December 13th of last month, last month, we officially launched the Data Analytics Master Contract Program. One thing that we really learned from the first piece in April was by including other stakeholders from different state agencies, we expanded the scope of this contract program from the 5 areas that were highlighted within the state government finance bill and the Health and Human Services bill to 12 different categories. And so we went above and beyond what was asked by the legislature because of the interest that we saw from different state agencies. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. I want to speak a little bit to the enterprise collaboration efforts that we did. I mentioned the focus group that represented 12 different agencies and had 30 different representatives. The steering team that really helped us guide the whole program to completion, which had 9 representatives from 8 different agencies, including admin, DHS, corrections, employment and economic development, transportation, labor and industry, and MMB. And then we had an evaluation team that had 30 subject matter experts from 8 different agencies. In total, this is more than 100 state employees which participated in some manner to assist with the planning activities, the RFP development, the evaluation process, the contract negotiations, or program administration implementation. Because of this considerable energy and dedication that was demonstrated to utilize these important tools, there's a lot of optimism and anticipation that this program will be an important factor in realizing continuous improvement objectives statewide. If you're not familiar with the concept of a master contract, this is something that's relatively new within the past, I would say, 5 years or so with state government, and it's been very successful. One area in particular, which we can talk about more at a separate time, is on the IT consultant work, which we have an ASAP IT master contract program, which allows state agencies to quickly utilize or quickly access consultant skills for IT services by direct selecting with a group of pre-qualified vendors. We have, the Department of Administration has the statutory authority to develop master contract programs, which contain uniform terms and conditions, has a detailed, a generic set of services that can be engaged at any agency's option, defines the maximum price terms, promises no work to contractors until it's authorized with a fully executed work order that defines the duties of the specific engagement. So we develop the master contract, but then each agency has the ability to develop work orders that would be specific to the needs of that department. There are a number of advantages of developing a master contract program. Primarily to achieve significant cost savings, promote efficiencies, and achieve quality improvements by taking a lot of the front-end work that would be typically done by state agencies and doing that all at once from the Department of Administration, so all the state agencies are able to quickly select the contractor that they would want to work with. I highlighted 4 advantages on the screen. One is administrative efficiencies, which avoids redundancies and a siloed agency-centric approach. 2 is cost avoidance, because we believe that the competitive prices yield favorable costs and terms for immediate leverage. And it also allows for further price negotiations once the maximum terms have been set when the actual work order is developed by the state agency. Quality assurance, because it's done centrally, We can monitor performance and ensure issues are quickly addressed and resolved. And then the speed and administrative ease, because agencies are not impaired by overly burdensome requirements that is typically done with the RFP process. Before I go into the specific service categories of the data analytics, I'd like to pause and see if there are any questions about the master contract process to this point.
Questions from the committee? Seeing none, you may proceed.
So as I mentioned, the legislative mandate had us pursuing five different service categories, and as a result of engagement with state agencies and getting some more stakeholder engagement, we expanded that list to 12 different service categories. The top four are ones that were discussed by the legislation, and also number seven, strategic sourcing. But we added unemployment compensation, workers' compensation, a customer-focused data analytics program, continuous organizational and quality improvement, strategic planning and data quality analysis. And then to increase participation from small businesses and targeted group businesses, we wanted to include other categories that were possibly able to be utilized by smaller companies, and that was more in the line of support services for some of these other programs. And so, as you'll see when we get into the specifics of who actually was awarded contracts, two of those contracts were by small and targeted group businesses. So if you turn to that next page, you'll see the 22 approved vendors, everyone from Accenture to Health Management Systems, IBM, Johnson Controls, Tax Management Association, Associates, but then there's two others, the Improv Group and Charter Solutions, that are a targeted group business contractors. All of these have signed contracts that are currently with the state, and all state agencies are able to directly work with these vendors to develop work orders as they see fit. If you merge the service category and the vendors on slide 12, you'll see that some approved contractors there were multiple approved contractors for each service category, except in the area of fleet management, which we just had IBM as approved contractor. But this allows additional competition for each state agency as they're looking into a service category. They can work with and get quotes from a number of approved contractors as they see fit. So just to this point, a number of vendors are approved for services with the state in multiple service categories.
Commissioner, with regard to this slide, how do you avoid conflicting messages or results from when you have more than one consultant on a given topic? Is it that you're going to be very specific as to what you're looking for from each of the vendors, or is there going to be a need to coordinate and avoid duplication and all the rest?
Sure. Excellent question, Mr. Chair. This allows for increased competition on the work order level. So these are approved from centrally from the Department of Administration, but as a agency looks into what their specific needs are and how they might work with one of these areas, take tax analytics, for example, there might be some of these companies that offer different solutions than other companies, and the Department of Revenue might only be looking to work with or get quotes from, or at least to learn about the services from, a number of these companies for a specific area, and then allows for further competition as they negotiate the work order. However, once the work order is only developed with a specific company, so there's no once that's determined, then that agency would work with one specific vendor for that scope.
So we don't get into a situation where you've got two different, three different vendors that are responding to the same issue.
There might be a situation where they would be responding to the same issue, but they would not be working on the same issue at the same time.
Okay.
You want to add anything to that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, one of the benefits of the program, I think, in the way we've set it up is that it does allow for a subsequent level of competition where there are multiple vendors. So in those cases and at certain dollar levels, it's actually required where the vendor has to write out, or the agency has to write out a statement of work that contains evaluation criteria and describes upon the criteria that the vendors would be scored, and the vendors respond at certain dollar levels. Under those established dollar levels, they can do a direct select based on information that's on our website. We have their complete statements of work posted so the agencies can peruse the website and look at what the vendors have to offer.
Representative Benson.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. This could be for either. I'm interested in finding out. I know this is new. In fact, that you know, your timeline shows that it's just been formally launched December the 13th. I'm wondering, has any agency approached any of these vendors to this point? And can we conclude from this, this was a may but not a must, that in actuality, once these have been let, that they're going to be actually used?
Sure.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, there are a number of agencies that are currently in, I wouldn't say negotiation, but in conversation with the vendors themselves. I know that on the next page we'll get to a few specific categories, particularly with DHS, revenue, the Department of Administration, and then other agencies that we didn't even expect to be thinking about this type of work, is certainly looking at how they it might be useful for their processes within their agencies. So we can go over a few of those in a minute, but I also just want to speak to that point that this isn't because of what I believe the approach that we took of really engaging state agencies early on and ensuring that we were developing a program that made sense for what they were trying to pursue. We didn't want to force them into a situation that maybe didn't make sense for what their business processes were, but we did want to make sure that they were pursuing a contract with a company that really added to what they were doing. In the areas of tax analytics and Medicaid fraud, I mean, those are kind of, I wouldn't say no-brainers, but they're certainly a clear indication from those agencies that they wanted to add on to the current tools that they were using in those areas. We're very excited about the interest that these agencies have been showing with this program. It's also, as I mentioned in the beginning, a clear interest from the governor. We've discussed at a number of cabinet meetings how each agency might be using these contracts. So I think that you'll see over the next few months that a lot of these agencies will be utilizing these contracts, and we can provide some results at a later point in time.
Representative Benson.
Thank you. I think you just answered my question. However, I guess I would like for you to make an official visit back to the committee before we end this session to give us a report on just exactly who is committed to using the new tools. Thank
Absolutely.
You. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I had a question, and that's probably a lead-in to your next page as far as Department of Human Services, is they now have this Office of the Inspector General that's supposed to look at fraud not only from Medicare but child care and everything. So does this just interact with that office, or how are they complementary, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative, everything that all this will be done in accordance with what the agency needs. And so the agency the individuals developing the work orders. We're providing a service to the agency, but it's the agency themselves that are working with these vendors to add on to the services that they provide. I don't know the particulars of how this contract would interact with the new Office of Inspector General, and I might pass it off to Betsy in case she has any further details, but we rest assured that this won't be a separate or kind of add-on to something they're doing, but in conjunction with and in tandem with current work that they're pursuing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would just add that I do know that the Department of Human Services is quite interested in this program. They are we're very active as members of our steering team and, in fact, are working on a statement of work as we speak. Interestingly, the Wisconsin equivalent is also interested in using the contract. One of the benefits of the program is that we advertised in the RFP that it would be open to other governmental entities that wanted to use the contract. So the other, our human services counterpart has expressed interest in this as well.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, just a statement. I know we had a lot of back and forth on these kinds of topics last legislative session, and I'm sure we could all find ways to poke a hole here or there in the process or the timing or whatever. But from my perspective, this is a pretty substantive response. I know there was internal initiative in the executive branch, but there was a lot of initiative from the legislative branch as well. So it feels to me like this is really a substantial step in the direction that we've all been talking about. So thank you for doing that. A couple of questions. The $100,000 threshold to do a kind of a sole selection, is that typical? My recollection is that the number was $25,000, and if it was above that, then you had to at least to do something somewhat competitive. Is this a unique structure, or is $100,000 the typical threshold?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to pass it up to Betsy Hayes, our contract manager, who would know a little bit more about that threshold level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, the $100,000 level has been used in the past for similar master contract programs. The commissioner mentioned the ASAP IT program, which also uses that $100,000 level. The $25,000 that you referenced, that is the standard advertising level for commodities. For professional services, it's actually $5,000 is required. And so we meet that advertising requirement by the issuance and the advertising of the master contract level. So that's how these master contract programs are set up. So certainly, though, all of our materials, we are very big on promoting competition, so we encourage the use of a competitive process even below $100,000, but it's not required in all cases.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another question. Are there any of these areas, your service categories, where there was not a vendor interested in doing this on a success fee basis? And I know you weren't prescriptive that it had to be success fee based, but and my recollection is that there was at least an option that you could do specific contracts off of this master list on a success fee basis. Are there anywhere that just didn't work out, or that isn't typically the way they interact with you?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, there were a number, I would say about half, and I don't remember offhand what categories, but about probably half of the vendors did offer a contingency fee basis of some sort, and I could certainly follow up with you to give you the areas and the contractors who do offer such a contingency basis.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And then one final question, and I'll just say, take you up on that offer to see some of the information in these categories. And so the bigger question is, so how can we in the legislature take advantage, if you will, of these new master contract relationships? There's still a bunch of bills that we're processing even this year, future initiatives that we might want to explore, and it seems to me there's a ready-made set of capabilities and things that we could avail ourselves of and educate ourselves on. Any recommendations for us in terms of the legislature taking advantage of these new master contracts with our bills and the things that we're thinking about?
Sure.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just a quick thought on that. I would encourage you to just continue to work with the agencies themselves. Like one benefit that we really see from this program is that it starts from what the agencies need, and then adding another tool to their toolbox in terms of how they can achieve more cost savings and greater efficiencies within their services. And so because we've developed the infrastructure and the administrative ease to enter into these contracts, it will be a matter of how each agency then pursues this on their own. And so as the legislature looks at the scope and services of each agency, I think it'll be important to say, here's another tool that you can use. Here's how you can take advantage of even enhancing the work that you're doing. And I think that would be something to consider.
Commissioner, I'm pleased to hear that so far that you have a good response from all the different agencies. I would hope that's the case. And in your discussions with the representatives from the different agencies, has there been discussion about keeping their respective committees at least somewhat apprised as to what's going on? And is that been a topic of discussion in the group?
Mr. Chair, for the for the kind of, I would say, the big three of tax analytics, Medicaid fraud, and then strategic sourcing and fleet management and building efficiencies from admin, I think that those three are well aware of what their responsibilities are in getting back to their committees. For the, some of the smaller groups, we can certainly reach back out to them and make sure that they're looping in their respective committees about the enhanced work that they might be doing through these master contract programs. And so I'll certainly take you up on that suggestion and make sure that all agencies that are pursuing this contract talk to their respective committees about the work that they're doing.
Well, Commissioner, thank you. And I this is very important work, and I commend you, too, for the work that you've done in preparing this. And I think it's very important that we as legislators be kept abreast of what's happening, what the issues are, concerns that there are, because in the end, any changes we're going to want to make are going to have to be approved through the legislative process. So I think that's very important to keep that in mind. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, a couple of questions. One is, I guess, to the majority members of this committee, because you guys control the legislature. Is there any thought of bringing the legislature into this? For example, just how the Legislative Coordinating Commission uses the Department of Finance to process all their checks and so forth. Is there any reason why the House, and they, I think they've found it to be totally satisfactory, is there any reason why the House and Senate need to keep separate finance departments and couldn't have the Department of Finance processing all of their checks too?
Representative Kahn, that's a good question. And
you're in a better position to ask it than I am.
So. Yeah. Well, I know that we've had some of our members that have been wanting to see us be able to do some things cooperatively here between the House and the Senate, rather than having separate operations on this, that, or the other thing. And so, rest assured, I will keep asking those questions.
Okay. And then I guess I have another question to the two people who are testifying. I'm sorry I was late. Yeah, separate problem. Going back to page 4, where you talk about governors and legislative charge to make continuous improvement part of the DNA of state government, can either of you tell us what the base pairing rules of DNA are?
No.
I just, you know, don't you think that, for example, if you said this was a traffic signal for state government, you'd know that red meant stop and green meant go? I just object to the use of terms when people don't know what they mean.
Mr. Chair Representative, I apologize. Not a biology major.
Right. Well, I, you know, again, it's like saying I'm not a history major, so I don't know that Washington was the first president of the United States. Sure. I think there are certain general knowledge things that everybody ought to know.
Representatives? No? Okay. Yeah. Any other questions at this point? I would like for you to say something about the schedule from here on. And have you set any kind of timelines where you're hoping to have some of these completed? And if not, when will that be done, or how will you go about trying to determine that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, just to speak to that point, we know that since the program was launched, a number of agencies have been very aggressive in how they've been working with prospective vendors to develop a work order. And, you know, particularly in the area of Medicaid fraud, tax analytics, and then within the Department of Administration, vendor audits come to mind. But those are currently being pursued, and I would imagine within a short order, those vendors will be working with those state agencies. because this is such of interest by both the legislature and by the Dayton administration, we expect to see some real results quickly, but I'm not going to put a time frame on that. To the representative's request earlier, we're happy to present what findings we have seen before the end of this legislative session, so you're fully aware of what's taken place so far. I don't know if there's any other time frames that are associated with it, but we certainly are excited about the work, and each state agency now knows that these contracts are available for them to use. We've developed a website where they can all look at the different vendor options and the different areas that they can be pursuing in this to make sure it's of administrative ease. I know I've sent personally about three or four emails to all my colleagues in different state agencies talking about this program, and as I mentioned, we've also discussed it at a number of cabinet meetings as well. So,
Commissioner, is it the hope or goal that you would have some results of this that would help influence the preparation of the budget for the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, certainly the hope, and it's certainly a goal. I mean, that was part of why we were charged with this initiative, and we wanted to make sure that we were looking under every rock for different savings that we could find. Hopefully the timing of it will help influence the preparation for the budget of next year.
Thank you. Any other questions? Anything else, Commissioner? Okay, thank you
very much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
The next item on the agenda is House File 673, Representative Banyan. Representative Banyan, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, on the formality, I will. I do not need that. Thank you. We don't need it. Let you cheat. On the formality of this, Mr. Chairman, I move that this committee pass and send to the Ways and Means Committee House File 673.
Okay.
Thank you. And this bill is a bill for a public value impact statement. I see my hand is still on here. I'm going to wait to have.
Well, maybe wait a long time.
All right, then. We'll just go ahead and proceed. There we go. This bill, House File 673, is a request to legislators, a mandate, in fact, to legislators. We don't request stuff, I guess, around here. It's a mandate to legislators that they state plainly what they intend by the bills that they write. This legislation calls for any bill that increases public spending, imposes financial obligations on a unit of local government, or regulation on the private sector, to have that chief author write a statement that says what their intention is, why they think the benefits of the bill they're writing warrant the costs that we imposed on taxpayers, on local governments, or businesses. This bill is just that. It's simply a requirement asking you as legislators to make a plain statement of what your intentions are with bills you write. I've described for you what's in here, and I would encourage you to read through Part B of the bill, beginning with line 1.13, that identifies what it is we would hope to find in your statement. Simply an anticipated cost and benefits of the bill to the Minnesota economy, the anticipated effects of the bill on the elderly, persons with disabilities, Minnesota citizens living in poverty, regulatory burdens of the bill, and why the author believes those benefits outweigh the burdens, and then the justification for increased financial obligations that are placed upon local government, I've spoken to folks in local government, some folks in local government who have said to me that they think that is a good idea, and I generally believe this to be so. I've brought with me, Mr. Chairman, Professor John Spry from the University of St. Thomas, who would like to say a few things about this bill, if I may, at this time.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Lanning, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is John Spry. I'm an economics professor at the University of St. Thomas, where, among other things, I teach cost-benefit analysis. And I am speaking here today only as a private citizen from St. Paul, and my views are solely my own and not those of any current or former employer. House File 673 is a good government proposal to include a public value statement, including both benefits and costs of new spending, regulations, or financial obligations on local government. And as former state lawmaker and President Abraham Lincoln said in 1847, there are few things wholly evil or wholly good. Almost everything, especially of government policy, is an inseparable compound of the two, so that our best judgment of the preponderance between them is continually demanded. And so by considering both costs and benefits, you're going to be in a better position to argue affirmatively when a bill, whether it's through spending or regulation, is going to create value by having benefits that exceed the cost. And in addition to considering the issue of total value creation by a bill, in cost-benefit analysis, it is very common to also look at the effects on other groups, as House File 673 does, in requiring the effects on the elderly, persons with disabilities, and citizens in poverty. So in summary, in general, it's a good practice when making any kind of decision to consider both costs and benefits, and to be deliberate, and given that the cost of written information and storage have really dropped, it's a particularly good idea for government and the legislative process to have a record of the author's intended benefits and costs of a proposal. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Banyan, do you envision some type of form or guide to how this should be written? I mean, frankly, I would think for me just to put an Erdahl bill, it should be good enough. But I mean, will there be more to that?
Bear me.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erdahl. It's a good question. The form of this is really meant to be a plain language summary of what one sees as the benefit and cost of the bill. The form of it, I believe, would look like a note that you would write. I would not imagine it taking more than a page or two for you to do so. And I would also imagine that would be something that one would draft as you drafted the bill. You'd have this formal language, and we imagine when we write many of our bills, we send a note to the reviser. Give me I send a note to the research office. Say, can I have a bill that looks like this? Okay, and then it comes back, and you and I both know it comes back in this language that sometimes we don't all completely understand, because not all of us are lawyers here. But for those of us that are not, it gives us a chance to read it in plain language and to give that statement of what the benefits and costs that the author sees to be. And it gives the rest of us the ability to see that. So I consider it a bill that promotes both transparency in the legislature and accountability for the bills we write.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, I have a couple questions. One is, I just wonder, are there states doing this, or did you come up with this idea out of your academic background, or just thought it was a good idea, or kind of wondering where the bill came from?
Oh, it's a good question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Slawick, it's a good question. In fact, as I researched this, I have not seen other states doing something similar. This was simply this was a simple idea that came from a discussion with a couple other private people and actually a bill I discussed with Representative Downey at one time and we thought this was a good idea and I decided to bring this forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
So it's an interesting idea. I think what where Representative Erdahl was going is when we write bills, of course we think the benefits outweigh the burdens. I mean, this is what we do as elected officials. We're elected to make these kinds of decisions and to hear bills and to make these kinds of decisions through the process. So it strikes me as odd that we would go through this when we think of things, the anticipated effects of the bill on the elderly, persons with disabilities, and Minnesota citizens living in poverty. I mean, if you take the philosophy of what government is really for or what government is about, and part of that is that safety net, so you take something like child care is about helping people that are on welfare, the parents, get off their feet and get into the workplace. It's that transition from welfare to work. So if you're going to increase if you're going to cut the rate by 2.5%, you just kicked a whole bunch of people that are trying to get into self-sustaining mode off. If you do the reverse, you're trying to help people become self-sustaining. I mean, a lot of these arguments are really, really complex, and I think that this is why we go through committee. This is why we have committees. This is why we have bills that are, you know, where they're all introduced, they're all public, they all come out in front of the public. So to me, Representative Banyan, and I know you're a great proponent of efficiency, it just doesn't seem very efficient.
Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Slawick, I believe in efficiency too, but I also believe in transparency. And I believe that the citizens of our state have a right, in fact, to find out what it is that's happening here. We don't make it terribly easy, I think, for our citizens to see what it is that we're doing here. This is a way for us to see when you write a bill, you and I, when we write bills, we know what we intend. And when we come down here and testify, you and I get to hear that. The folks that are in this room have to go through the effort of finding where on a tape we talked about this bill. I think at what I believe to be a really low cost, we can make that information available to them easier, more readily, and I think efficiently. I think it's worth it to give our citizens the ability to gain that information in a clear language way at relatively low cost. The cost of information has dropped so dramatically over the last 15 years. I think it's time for an opportunity for people to find out what it is we're doing here, and I think this bill helps.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, I wanted to ask, kind of related to some of Representative Slawick's questions, why don't we call this statement of intent as opposed to public value impact statements? My impression of the title public value impact statements is that we're going to then debate what public value is, whereas you're saying it's just simple, it's just a statement of intent. And that way we don't have to debate the public value impact statement as well as the bill.
Representative Banyan.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Green, that's a good question. I like the word impact rather than intent because I believe that what we're really trying to do is to show what the impact of our legislation is on what we produce here. And what we produce here, I believe, is in fact a public value. So I think that because the bill discusses it in terms of burdens and benefits, that the result of that, the balance between those, represents an impact. And I think that word's important. I'm not willing to fight over that word too terribly much if you really felt that you needed something different there. But I think the word but I do think the word impact is a better description of what it is these statements do than just simply saying the word intent.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that not what the committee process is for, though, to air that debate and discussion and provide that transparency?
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Green, as I indicated in my answer to Representative Slawick, that's true for you and me, and we do this here in full view of the public. My goal is to actually have an easier way for people to for citizens to see what it is we do here and what our legislation intends to do. I want my citizens, my constituents, to be able to see in plain language what it is that I have actually proposed to do here in the legislature. I would think you would want that as well.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course I want that, but I also want to respect my constituents with the fact that, by acknowledging the fact that these issues are complex and they can't be boiled into one sentence. I think that the example that Representative Flowick gave was a really good one. If we're cutting child care to support families in poverty, like, we're going to both have different takes on what benefit that is achieving, and I think if we put this in the realm of statement of intent, then we'll kind of acknowledge this is somebody's opinion as opposed to masking it as a value statement when yours and my value statement would probably be really different from one another. Thank you.
I don't know that I have an answer. I don't have anything to respond to that.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you might imagine, I like this bill a lot. And some of the discussion we just had right now, I think, substantiates why it's necessary. The degree of hyperbole that you hear about the value of a certain bill or the outcome has way less to do with that, what actually happens on the ground after that legislation gets implemented, and way more about the author's intent, well-intended as it may be. Whether or not their legislation actually accomplishes anything after the fact is a bigger question. And in this time where we're trying to set priorities, you know, Washington State has a priority-based budgeting system where they really do articulate and try to measure some of these program outcomes. I know our Sunset Commission is underway, and they're struggling because the operations that they're looking at don't really have any measurement systems. We can talk, and we can put out our campaign brochures about all the value in the world, but we have no way to track whether we're actually accomplishing anything. So I think we have a need for departments to increase the measurement systems that they have. We just heard a report from admin talking about our performance measurement system, and one of their challenges in evaluating employee performance is they don't have any departmental measurements or outcomes that they track, so they have no idea whether their employees are actually contributing to that or not. We've asked DEED to provide some kind of a common framework to even evaluate all the workforce programs we have. I've listened to bonding bills in higher ed, and every single one of them comes in and talks about all the jobs they're going to create and all, you know, the value of all this stuff, and no one ever does anything other than produce the price tag. And so we have a requirement for fiscal notes, and we have a requirement here in the legislature for local government impact notes, but we have nothing that says when you add a new bill, a new law, a new appropriation, you are not required at all to substantiate what this thing is going to do. And so in my mind, this is just an extra degree of accountability for us as legislators to say that if you're going to start adding stuff to the complex of state government as compared to everything else that today added up, we don't hardly measure at all, let's not keep adding to that. Let's make sure that the new stuff we put in has at least some degree of measurement and some degree of outcome that we're going to try and take a look back at when the Sunset Commission's comes back around and has to look at these agencies and these programs, that they've got something to rely on other than political rhetoric. But my question, if I could, for Mr. Spry, I know this gets really tricky when you try and measure value in the public sector, because, for example, what's the value of keeping a convicted rapist away from the public? I mean, it's really hard to measure that. How do you, from an academic standpoint or an economic standpoint, try to put some measurement on that, or do you not? I think the intention, I shouldn't say this, but I think the intention of the author is that there are cases where you can't put some kind of a number on that. Do you have methods in the academic world where you can start to actually define the value or kind of the measurement systems for public programs that are really hard to measure?
Dr. Spry?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Downey, there is an extensive body of knowledge that has been developed to measure costs and benefits, even in situations where it might be a little bit difficult. So there's actually a plain English economic journal which is kind of nice to drop the math, called the Journal of Economic Perspective, and they've published over time a number of articles analyzing the costs and benefits, for example, of sulfur dioxide reduction in the Los Angeles basin, which is very famous for smog. And so you might say we could measure the cost of creating a sulfur dioxide market because there are additional costs that largely businesses pay for these pollution permits. And so you can measure that in dollars, but how could you measure clean air? How do you put a value on clean air? But in fact, economists studying in the environmental economics have discovered a quite regular pattern that in areas with better air quality, controlling for other things like the size of the house or the age of the house, houses sell for more because people, all things being equal, would take the better house, which would be the house with better air quality. And even for something, and I would think sulfur dioxide would be an externality just like crime, where you could measure the value of crime, people have been able to put a dollar value. This bill does not require that level of detail, so you might have, for example, on a regulation, this is anticipated to reduce this type of pollution by this much, and we have a general idea that that's particularly valuable, maybe in the elderly or for people in general. Another example in understanding benefit cost analysis is you might think of something like a state park. And if you created a new state park or made improvements to a state park, how do you value fun? And in fact, there's a method in the cost benefit analysis literature based on the travel cost. If you have a better park, people that are traveling to that park, even though you may not pay to get in the park, you're paying an opportunity cost of your time and the wear and tear on your car and gas to travel to the park. So if you improved a park and you found that the circle of people that regularly visit the park has expanded, there are ways to infer from that very much public value, even from something that officially is free. So there is an extensive literature, and I have some references I can share with you privately on entire books and series of books looking at cost-benefit analysis. That's not the level that's required in House File 673, but particularly for people, and I'm one of those people, who thinks there are a number of things that the public sector does that creates value where the benefit of the regulation outweighs the cost, or the benefit of a particular program outweighs the expenditure. I think it would create more respect generally if we had this type of information available for the public, not just immediately, but over time, to look back and say, that's what the program was supposed to do, and in fact, that's what it's doing, and those benefit costs analysis come out that it's quite a winner.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bannon, looking at this and just thinking of a bill that I have on auto tampering and coming up with a value, I have a fiscal note for $60,000. But under your bill, I could say, for example, we have last year we had an individual who had been picked up 43 times and convicted for auto tampering and misdemeanor under the law, so his probation gets extended. So that's not a cost included there. I have no way of knowing the value of all the automobiles he damaged, all the things he stole, but I know it would be beneficial if he wasn't on the street. So how I write that up in this thing, I have no way of measuring that. So what it really comes down to then is what my spin is. You know, and if I can write better spin than you can, then I have a better value impact statement. And that concerns me because, you know, those are my debate points, why we need to have this law to take people like this character who's last year 43 is probably up to 63 by now. Who knows? So then Then on the other hand, some of my colleagues might say, you know, felony's a little harsh, Representative Gauthier, and, you know, and then we're going to have more prison beds and blah, blah, blah. And you hear all that argument. And so what I see this as is you're just telling me I have to outline my debate points and why I think a bill is good or not. And then on the end of your bill, in Section 2, you're talking about a public value impact statement must be maintained on official records in the House of Representatives and Senate committees. What bothers me is we're creating more paperwork, and it's not really an efficiency in my mind. So can you respond to those two things, and then I may or may not have another question for you.
Okay.
Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gauthier. I would not consider it spin to go through the thought process of thinking about, for example, for your auto tampering bill, what the benefit is of getting this fellow with the 43 crimes off the street versus that there's a benefit to that. There's a cost to, as you point out, cost of making it a felony rather than a misdemeanor in terms of the potential that you actually need more jail space. I think it's useful for all of us to think about that. You'll, of course, as anyone would, you wouldn't be writing that bill if you thought the cost didn't fall short of the benefits. You think the burden is worth accepting. And that's why you wrote the bill. We would want to know why you think that. Nothing more, nothing less. Why do you think that? Write it down in a way that folks can read, our citizens can understand, and then let them weigh in. Let them see, you know, suppose we pass your bill. 5 years from now, we'd want to know, how did it turn out? This is the accountability that I hope we're all willing to put upon ourselves as legislators. As to the paperwork question, of course, it'll be paper here. There'll be a few more bits of paper here. But maintaining records can often be done in an electronic form. I certainly don't expect that these public value impact statements will be bound into a book anywhere. But I've spoken with professional staff here, and our belief is that my intention here is that they are probably the folks that know best how to provide this in a cost-effective way. And I'm going to trust our professional staff to make decisions on how to maintain them, just giving them the instruction that it shall be kept as an official record.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gauthier.
I'll follow. Representative Banyan, when you have a PVIS, I guess, public value impact statement, and I'm the author of it because it's the author of the bill, and you talked about needing to do this for transparency, but isn't that only one side of the argument? That doesn't sound like transparency to me. It sounds like that's Representative Gauthier's position. And that's a really, you know, and I'm fine with that, you know. If I believe it, I stand on it. But it really isn't transparency for the process. It's just one man's opinion or one woman's opinion or belief system. So I don't see how this adds to transparency. I'm kind of confused about that. And being a simple West Duluth boy, I'd like you to explain it to me.
Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gauthier. Transparency comes in the form of letting citizens know, what did you mean when you wrote this bill? What does this bill do, in your own words? What does it say? They can read all kinds of records. They can read the bill language itself. They can read a House research summary that our nonpartisan staff writes. They can read a newspaper article. But I would think it would be useful for a citizen to learn, your citizens in West Duluth to know, what it is that you wanted to do with such and such a bill. And to let other folks know, what did you want to do with this bill? And I call that transparency, but I call it just as much so an accountability. that at some point later you are going to, you know, someone's going to go back and say, you passed this bill or you pushed for that bill, and people will know what it is you were doing while you were here, and I think that's important too.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gauthier.
I guess we'll just disagree about what transparency is, because I think part of the transparency is the political argument that goes on in committee and on the House floor. And making one side present a position and not the other side so people can quickly look it up on the internet, I don't think adds anything to good government. So I guess we'll just agree to disagree.
Representative Meline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, I have a question in how this would apply to bonding bills and whether or not this would be, the analysis would be a statewide benefit or a regional benefit. I'm thinking of a bill that I have right now, which is for a new wastewater treatment plant in my district. There's actually a construction moratorium in my district because one of our wastewater treatment plants is at full capacity. So we actually have manufacturing businesses that want to expand and some new businesses that want to go in, and they can't because the wastewater treatment plant can't handle it. And there's also a great environmental risk right now with, we have a catastrophe basically on our hands if something would go wrong because our plant is operating at full capacity. So what I was planning on doing for my bill was, you know, to have some of my constituents come in, some of my business owners come in, talk about being able to expand their businesses, build new homes with a new wastewater treatment plant. You know, maybe have the mayor and city council members come in and talk about how many more toilets they'll be able to flush in a new plant. But so obviously a new plant would be a great benefit to my district and my constituents. So I'm just wondering how I would balance that with what the statewide benefit would be.
Representative Banyan?
That's a good question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moline. I have two responses. One of them is that this bill, as I understand the bill, and when it says new level of public spending, that would include bonding. I'm going to look over at Mr. Shepherd to be sure I'm right about that. I believe it does. Certainly, if I'd written my intention for this, I would have included that. I would have thought that would be there. It would have done that. And it sounds to me, in fact, like you've just given us a very fine description of your bill, and that would seem to me to be transcribe what you just said. It sounds like that could form an impact statement. Let me give you a second answer, though, and I don't mean to advertise my other bills here, but I do have a separate bill that deals specifically with bonding proposals, House File 369, that would actually look specifically at the kind of bill that you've just described, and it's a different set of rules. It's a different type, a little more formal type cost benefit analysis, as Dr. Spry just discussed, that would apply for capital investment. So one could imagine maybe doing something more along the lines of what you said with using your mayor and so on, and doing that comparison of the local benefit versus the statewide benefit versus the statewide cost.
Representative Meline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Banyan and members. I think that, you know, right now we're trying to avoid redundancy in government, and it sounds like this bill, unfortunately, is going to do a lot of things that we already do. The public already has access to all of our committee hearings online. They have access to our floor sessions. They have access to the process we already use to vet bills. So, you know, I think that we should avoid adding more burdens to our staff and try to move towards a more efficient government. So I'd encourage you to vote no. Thanks.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, you know, I was wondering if you might be open to an amendment, and then I was going to ask you and the testifier to respond to two specific ideas in terms of cost-benefit analysis. Line 1.6, after a new or increased level of public spending, to insert the word or decreased level of public spending. Because in the name of transparency, if somebody wants to do something like eliminate the homestead market value credit, wouldn't you really have to weigh the cost benefits of what's going to happen to the taxpayers, and that it's going to take up property taxes, and that people might lose their homes, and that seniors only have so much income? And the things that happen in this legislature every time we decrease spending or eliminate programs. So how about something like for homestead market value? How would you handle that? The other one is we're at a town meeting on Saturday, and we had some parents there that talked about how this legislature, remember we had that budget shut down, and this was all done over a weekend where there was no transparency and none of us were in the room. We cut payments to the parents who are providers. Representative Lilly is he in here? He was in there. Yeah. Remember that came up at our town meeting. So if someone wanted to propose something like that, the unintended consequences, what could happen, the transparency, the parents tell us that their child might have to go to an institution. The cost to the state, significantly higher. So would you have those other kinds of bills that in here, or decrease spending, or when people want to cut, or when you have a bunch of bills, or your budget bills come out and you're cutting all kinds of things? Where's the transparency there?
Representative Banyan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawik, if you would like to make that amendment, I would not oppose it.
Representative Simon, or Representative Slawik?
Okay, well, then if we can, if you would like to incorporate that, I'd appreciate it. But can your testifier give any cost-benefit analysis on those specific questions? Like you gave parks, you know, on parks and the unintended consequences, but when we eliminate things like tax credits?
Dr. Spry?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawik, When you make any decision, you can compare the costs and benefits. So in terms of the methodology, for example, if you to take the sulfur dioxide example, and you change the number of permits available, that could be an expansion of the program. It could also be, as you point out, a reduction in the program. You could calculate both the change and the cost, and this would be as a regulation. On the private sector, but also the change in the benefits from a different, in some ways, regulation of pollution. In a similar way, this is a little bit different than this particular bill, but I think all of you received the tax expenditure review report, which the Revenue Department wrote and I published, and I was one of the co-authors along with five other economists from higher ed institutions in Minnesota, and they're looking very specifically at tax expenditures. There is an entire methodology set out, much more expansive than this, that could look at both expansion, and actually does look both at expansions and reductions of tax expenditure. So the basic ideas of comparing cost and benefit and the methodology that's been developed about cost benefit analysis is symmetric with respect to increased or decreased levels of regulation or increased or decreased levels of expenditures or tax expenditures.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawik.
Council gave me a piece of paper on maybe how to do the amendment, so what I will do is during the next question I'm just going to talk with them.
Okay. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, thanks for the bill. I think it's a great discussion, a useful discussion. I feel like I'm channeling Tom Emmer a little bit, though, here, because I served on many a committee with him, and we got along very well. And the one thing that he was fond of saying, or at least conveying, was not everything worth doing is worth doing in statute. There are plenty of things that the people ought to do and that are good things, but we really need to codify every good deed or good behavior thing that we might do. So I guess my question to you is, why do we need a bill? I mean, everything you're saying, almost everything you're saying, seems to me a good thing for people to do in this place. Why do we need a bill?
Representative Banyan.
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Simon. I would actually point out the last sentence of the bill. Public value impact statement must be maintained with official records of House of Representatives and Senate committees. I don't think we can do that without a bill.
Representative Simon.
Well, okay. I mean, I guess fair enough. I guess my other worry with this, as well-intentioned as you obviously are, and this makes a lot of sense for people to do, I mean, it's basically sort of the elevator speech that you might give about why your bill is a good idea.
Very good.
And I understand that's a good thing to do when we're testifying, like now, good thing to do on the floor. But I guess that one worry I would have is that over time, since this is a requirement, these would become increasingly generic, increasingly kind of plain vanilla. People would say things like, especially since line 1.21 talks about why the author believes the benefits outweigh the burdens, this certainly isn't a scientific process. This isn't the kind of thing that Professor Spry and others do in their work, quantifying cost-benefit. This is about belief, thought, feeling, intuition, gut. And I guess my worry would be that increasingly these would become generic statements. You might have somebody saying, well, this would be good for the happiness and well-being of all the people of Minnesota. What's to prevent something like that from happening? Why do you think this will be a meaningful document for people as opposed to just a press release?
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, I believe it would be better... I believe it will be better because I think legislators, if you think about, I like your example of the elevator speech. It made me smile because that is a pretty good description of what you're doing. Our elevator speeches are usually not generic. Our elevator speeches normally have something in them that is catchy. And to the extent that these do reflect that 30-second or 2-minute pitch, I expect that they're going to be non-generic. I think it's in the interest of the legislator to make sure that they do have something that attracts attention.
Representative Simon?
Well, I appreciate that. I think maybe we just have a difference of opinion about whether this needs to be in statute, but I think the discussion here is great, and ideally, on all bills, we should be having this discussion. I don't know whether we need, a formalized process like this, but I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
Back to Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepard must have read my mind or anticipated a little bit. It's a 5-line amendment. Mr. Shepard, do you want to explain it? Is that okay, Mr. Chair? Would that be appropriate?
Sure, Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I do have typed up something in my own notes that I'll give Mr. Glessing so that he'll have it in writing. But this is an attempt to implement Representative Slavik's suggestion that this apply to changes, not just increases. And so on page 1, line 6, the proposal would be to delete the words new or increased and insert different. On page 1, line 7, delete new or impose new or increased and insert different. Page 1, line 8, delete, impose, new, and insert different. Page 1, line 11, delete, new, and insert changes in, and then delete on the same line the words the increased. And page 1, line 12, delete the new.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slavik.
What I believe it does, and I've just seen it as well, is that it would be any kind of change. So it would be an increase or a decrease, but it's a cleaner way of wording it. So it kind of cleans up that section. And Representative Banyan, I don't know if you're still willing to incorporate that or if you've seen it.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Slavik, I'm just copying it down while Mr. Shepard's reading it to us.
I see that being acceptable. I'd be willing to accept that as a friendly amendment. So you would incorporate that?
I'll incorporate the change in the language.
Okay. The amendment is incorporated. Any question about that?
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to... The amendment is incorporated. Any question about that?
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to Representative Erdahl.
We need to vote on it. He said we need to vote on it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We need to have a vote then on the amendment. All in favor of the amendment supported by the author, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's becoming very surreal, I think, today. We have now a Banyan-Slawik bill. Representative Simon is quoting Tom Emmer. And Mr. Shepard is anticipating Representative Slawik's amendments before the meeting. So it's becoming a little strange. But the actual question that I have of Representative Banyan is where and how do you anticipate the statement being displayed?
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erdahl, at this time, we're still working this through with professional staff. Their direction is simply to find a cost-effective way to display this within the official record and make it available to the public. How it would, don't have the specific form of how it would do so, because I'm going to rely on them to make that call for us.
Members, we need to wrap this up here, and I would say in the next 10 minutes, because we have another important bill that we have to get to yet today as well. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, did you have a conversation with House Research and Revisor's Office about this bill?
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, we've had some discussion of this. We have not, I think, gotten to, I mean, they feel it's doable. It's not unduly burdensome, but in particular, referring back to Representative Erdahl's question in terms of the form in which this would be displayed, we have not completed that conversation.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
Representative Banyan, I ask that question in particular because my experience has been that when I put intent in or wanted intent, a paragraph of intent in bills, they tend not to come back with the intent part there. I think in my career, there's been like two exceptions that I can think of. And so it's not something that I had experience in having the revisors that do the writing embrace. Also, could, if we're carrying a bill for a constituent that a constituent has brought with to us and wants to testify and wants us to push this bill for that person, and we're not nearly as enthusiastic or knowledgeable about the situation as the constituent, could the constituent's words for intent and the summary be included rather than mine?
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy has not specifically considered that possibility. However, I think as long as one duly cites the person whose words actually appear, I think you could have author's intent, and then under author's intent, under the chief author's intent, an entry that says this bill was carried on behalf of constituent X. X says, quote. And then allow that to be there. And I think that would suffice. That would meet the requirements.
Thank you, Representative Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
We serve on a committee that seems to have a lot of bills submitted by request. Then, when we do that, would the by request be our statement of intent or the requester's statement of intent?
I don't know the answer to that. Representative Banyan, do you want to take a stab at that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not clear which committee you are referring to, if it's this one or a different committee.
Well, when one of us puts on a bill that we're doing it by request, It's basically saying it's really not our idea, but we're doing this as a courtesy to whoever is talking to us wanting this to be addressed. And so basically the intent then of the author is doing something that they've been requested to do by a constituent, and it may not be something that the author has real ownership on.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. However, I would think that would want to be reflected somehow.
Representative Murphy.
Chair, this is my last question for Representative Banyan. Then, if we don't include this part of the intent, then does our bill still have a chance of getting passed?
Representative Banyan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's really speculative. Who knows how a committee disposes of a bill? It's expected, rules of this body will say that there is a statement to be expected on a bill that now changes public spending under the amendment that we've just agreed to from Representative Slawik. So those are what the rules will say.
Mr. Chair, so these are not only we're changing the procedure by which how a bill is written and how the records are kept for that, the official records are kept, but we're also changing the rules of the House of Representatives. Is that my understanding?
Sure. Representative Banyan?
Well, Ms. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the bill is a direction to the legislator, and under if you look at line 2-1, the House of Representatives, Senate must each adopt rules specifying a process under which public value impact statements will be considered by committees considering bills. We'll leave that up to them. They may choose not to have this particular item included in it with bills that you carry on behalf of constituents or on behalf of others. They may choose not to. I can think of committees where they may choose to do so. But the point is, the bill does call for the House to adopt rules. So the direct answer to your question, Representative Murphy, is yes.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, I see that you've testified that the PVIS would not appear in statute. And do you have a question? Do you have a Senate author yet?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Kahn, yes, we do. Hopefully we'll get a hearing in front of the Government Innovation Committee, but Senator Chamberlain is offering the bill.
Okay. Well, part of my experience is that there's been a long cultural division between the House and the Senate, and maybe all this has changed now as we've seen kind of abuse of legislative culture. But the House has supported the concept of legislative intent appearing in bills and appearing in the statute, and the Senate has been uniformly opposed to it. I tend to be in favor of it, and I think if this is to have any value, it certainly ought to appear in statute with the bill and not in some obscure committee record that I don't think most of us know how to access, much less the general public. So, and I'm also just, when you look at some, when you think of, kind of a small couple of sentence bill and so forth, it might be nice to have this. When you think of something like the state government appropriations bill, particularly the one, look at the one from the last session, it seems to me that it would be an impossible task, and both to write it and to access it in any meaningful way.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Banyan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, we in fact do that if you think about the state government finance bill, Chair Lanning stood up on the floor of the House and gave a summary of the bill at the beginning of debate over it. That that summary that he gives at that time would be a very fine example of a public value impact statement.
I would have to go, Mr. Chairman, I would have to go over to look at it, but I would doubt if his summary covered all of the things that are listed, that are specifically listed as required to be done in this bill. So my comments are very simple. If this is to have any value, it should certainly appear. I noticed that this is codified. This is put into statute. This law is put into statute, and it seems to me if it's to have any value, what the law does should also end up being in statute, and it ought to be in a form that is amenable to that. So until I see something before me that does that, I intend to vote no on this.
Representative Meline.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll pass.
Members, we need to act on this so we can get to the next bill. So Representative Banyan renews his motion that House File 673 be recommended, that a recommendation be for it to pass and be referred to Ways and Means Committee as we have amended it here today. So all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carried. Bill is passed. Thank you, Professor Spry and Representative Banyan, and we'll call Representative Loeffler down next. Welcome, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I would, I will move your bill, House File 1288, to be recommended to pass and be sent to Capital Investments.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill is a result of a variety of initiatives over the past or the recent years to address a variety of issues related to capital security, accessibility by persons with disabilities, and other issues that our old capital complex faces. But this is now time critical, and that this bill provides the authority and the funding to replace the capital that goes underneath University Avenue from the Capitol to the parking lot across the way into the Department of Administration building. It implements the recommendations of the National Guard Security Task Force and the Capitol Security Task Force of last year to move the loading dock and receipt of materials away from the Capitol building and to separate out the handling of utilities and other sort of back-end services from the safe transportation of people and pedestrians through the tunnel system. I served last year on the Capitol Security Task Force along with Representatives Kelly Woodward, Representative Rick Hansen, Senator Michelle Benson, and Senator Warren Limmer, and it was strongly recommended by them that we move forward with this. If we don't do it before the light rail tracks are laid, it will obviously be much, much more expensive, if not impossible. And with me is our Nikki Giancola and Wayne Wislowski from the Department of Administration, who can answer specific questions you might have. I do need, Mr. Chairman, to make one amendment, and that is to the appropriation should be increased to $6.6 million on lines 1.6 and 1.15. We put in the request a year ago, introducing it with just some very preliminary understanding of what might be involved. And over the interim, the Department of Administration has been able to analyze the situation much more thoroughly and has come up with a final number that is included in the governor's bonding recommendations. With that, Mr. Chair,
I will move the amendment based on the fact that we now have more up-to-date cost projections. Discussion on that amendment? All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'll just, because of the time, just answer any questions and appreciate your consideration.
Questions from the committee. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. Two questions. One, would we have needed to do this tunnel repair irrespective of the Central Corridor light rail, or is this only necessitated because of that construction? And then secondly, in line 1.10 to 1.12, it says that there could be other things coming up. Do we know what those other things might be and what their potential costs might be?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Downey. This actually should happen even if there wasn't light rail, because of the security risk to the Capitol that our current tunnel system poses. And it was a strong recommendation out of the National Guard in its assessment of risk factors for the public as well and occupants of the Capitol complex. So this was a recommendation. In fact, I think you've seen the tunnel analysis that was done even before I think the final routes were decided for light rail. And so, no, this does need to be done. It's just the timing becomes more critical because of the work that will be done with light rail. The language related to, you know, continuing to address other issues was just, we put that in last year just because we felt there might be other things that needed to be accommodated as this, the planning on this went ahead, and that everybody should be talking to each other so that all the pieces fit together when this is finally implemented. But I don't anticipate any other cost items related to this.
I agree with Representative Loeffler's explanation, and I would add to that that we've got a problem currently with deliveries and very cramped quarters where you've got utilities, deliveries, and pedestrians all competing for the use of the space. So this really is needed irrespective of light rail. The light rail causes a time concern. If we don't get this done now, it's going to be a lot more costly down the road and problematic once light rail is in. And I want to point out, too, that the bipartisan CAP board, Capital Area Planning and Architectural Planning Board, has recommended last year that this project be incorporated. Very strong support from that board. Further discussion or questions? Representative Simon.
Yeah, just a quick question. Thanks, Representative Loeffler. Where is this tunnel going to? I guess I'm not clear. It's going from where to where?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon. It will replace the existing tunnel that goes from the Capitol across the street to the parking ramp, a lot that is directly north of the Capitol, and then it veers over to the Department of Administration building. So it's not one that many legislators use unless you're going to meetings at the Department of Administration, but it is used heavily by employees and others, and it will also serve, if at some point there was interest in taking that surface parking and turning it into something else, it will allow that to happen. But the major improvements that it will offer are related to the safety of materials handling, getting the loading dock away from the Capitol building itself, and the ADA compliance.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, there are a lot of concerns about the potential vibration that comes from the light rail impacting the Capitol. Does the proposed tunnel design take into consideration any mitigation of that possible problem that we may be facing?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Members, Wayne Wislosky with the Department of Administration. Representative, there's close coordination between the design teams between LRT and the tunnel, including putting in structural supports to protect the two across the university and the core building and the existing tunnel that goes over to the end. So they, both design teams are understanding the thresholds that are
impact. Any further questions, discussion? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 1288, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to Capital Investment Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler and staff. Thank you for being here today. Members, tomorrow we will have three reports from the state auditor. We will deal with House File 1903, Representative Erdahl's bill, and House File 1560, Representative Wardlow. And Thursday, of course, we do not have a meeting, so tomorrow will be the last meeting for the week. Members, meeting adjourned.